So I'm an assistant professor in human rights at the London School of Economics in the Department of Sociology and the Center for the Study of Human Rights, and I'll be chairing this event tonight. It's a pleasure to welcome you this gloomy evening. Thank you for being here. Although the events we have to talk about are not so pleasurable, to say the least, they are extremely, extremely disturbing. The event tonight, titled Emergencies of Peace, the Exceptional State of, in parentheses, Academic Affairs in Contemporary Turkey, is being brought to you by the research group that I lead at LSE called Internationalism, Cosmopolitanism, and the Politics of Solidarity, as well as the Center for the Study of Human Rights, which is hosting our event tonight. This event, as I mentioned, is being audio recorded, and technology permitting, we're going to hope to have a podcast of the event available and posted online in a couple of days. Audience members are encouraged to tweet about this event, in fact, institutionally encouraged, and our suggested hashtag is hashtag LSE Peace Turkey. I repeat that. Hashtag LSE Peace Turkey. You could tweet about the event and also post on Facebook if that's your preferred medium or whatever social media. I don't mean to advertise for anybody. Final warning, please do turn your phones to silent. It's only the panel members that need to switch it off. You can just keep your phones on silent. Before I introduce our speakers tonight, I thought I needed to do something in particular, which was to highlight two aspects of the grave situation and the immediate context in which this panel, which was organized in a rush to respond to current events in Turkey, takes place. One of the immediate, as you will be aware, most of you will be aware, I suppose, aspects of the current situation is the prosecution of more than 1,000 academics in and beyond Turkey, mostly citizens of Turkey, the Turks and Kurds and others, who have signed the petition calling for peace in Turkey. And I thought it was my duty, in fact, to read this petition to you in English, so that you can judge for yourselves why is it that these academics are being prosecuted by the Turkish state for quote-unquote spreading terrorist propaganda. Or in the words of Honorable President of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for engaging in academic terrorism. So you be the judge. I will simply read out the petition for which these academics have been prosecuted by state and parastate forces as well. It's not long. I quote, "The Turkish state has effectively condemned its citizens in Sur, Silvan, Nusaybin, Cizre, Silopi, and many other towns and neighborhoods in the Kurdish provinces to hunger through its use of curfews that have been going on for weeks. It has attacked these settlements with heavy weapons and equipment that would only be mobilized in wartime. As a result, the right to life, liberty, and security, and in particular, the prohibition of torture and ill treatment protected by the Constitution and international conventions have been violated. This deliberate and planned massacre is in serious violation of Turkey's own laws and international treaties to which Turkey is a party. These actions are in serious violation of international law. We demand the state to abandon its deliberate massacre and deportation of Kurdish and other peoples in the region. We also demand the state to lift the curfew, punish those who are responsible for human rights violations, and compensate those citizens who have experienced material and psychological damage. For this purpose, we demand that an independent national and international observers be given access to the region and that they be allowed to monitor and report on the incidents. We demand the government to prepare the conditions for negotiations and create a roadmap that would lead to a lasting peace, which includes the demands of the Kurdish political movement. We demand inclusion of independent observers from broad sections of society in these negotiations. We also declare our willingness to volunteer as observers. We oppose suppression of any kind of the opposition. We, as academics and researchers working on and in Turkey, declare that we will not be a party to this massacre by remaining silent and demand an immediate end to the violence perpetrated by the state. We will continue advocacy with political parties, the parliament, and international public opinion until our demands are met." Unquote. So this is the petition for which more than 1,000 academics are being charged for spreading terrorism propaganda in Turkey. Okay, this was the first aspect of the immediate context in which this panel takes place that I wanted to highlight. The second aspect, and so much could be highlighted, but the second part of the immediate context is the is, as we speak, the entrapment of 28 citizens of Turkey in a basement of a building in Cizre, which is a Kurdish town, technically within the borders of the Republic of Turkey. And reportedly, as an MP said in the Turkish parliament today, four of those people have already bled to death. They're entrapped. You see the image from Cizre circulating behind us on the PowerPoint. And reportedly already four of those citizens of Turkey have bled to death. So this is the immediate context. I don't mean to be engaging in agitation, but I do mean to give an account of the short time period in which this panel has been organized, and our very generous panelists have agreed to come here tonight. We have three speakers. They will be speaking in the order of alphabetical order, given their last names. It may come to you as a surprise, David. Daria already knew it, and so did Nazan. So without further ado, please do allow me to introduce our speakers tonight. Our first speaker will be Dr. Daria Bayır. Daria is the author of Minorities and Nationalism in Turkish Law, which is a book that came out 2 years ago, I believe. Her interests include international human rights and minority rights, law and religion, the Turkish legal system, and Ottoman pluralism. Dr. Daria Bayır obtained her doctorate from the Law Department of Queen Mary, where she is currently a visiting scholar. Last but not least, Dr. Bayır has litigated many cases before the European Court of Human Rights, including the prominent case of Güveç versus Turkey, and she remains a practicing legal consultant and lawyer. Our second speaker tonight will be Professor David Graeber, who teaches in the Department of Anthropology here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. David is too prolific of a writer to be a friend, so I will not be going through everything he has written. I will only mention five of his books. The Utopia of Rules on Technology, Stupidity, and the Secret Joys, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement, Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, and last but not least, Revolutions in Reverse, Essays on Politics, Violence, Art, and Imagination. Let me also note that David prefers to keep his theory and practice aligned. For the purposes of tonight's panel, let me note that he has taken trips to the Kurdish regions around Turkey, most recently to Rojava, and has written about the Kurdish liberation movement for a number of outlets, including The Guardian. Our last speaker connecting to us from Istanbul is Dr. Nazan Üstündağ. Dr. Nazan Üstündağ is an assistant professor at the Department of Sociology at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, which will be familiar to all of you. And she is a member of the Academics for Peace, who organized the petition. Dr. Üstündağ is one of the most prominent organic intellectuals to have emerged from Turkey in the last number of decades, I would say, and will be familiar to anyone following the Kurdish liberation movement in Turkey and beyond. Nazan is also too prolific for me as a writer for me to go through every single piece she has written, but let me just note that in the last issue of the South Atlantic Quarterly, which is a very prestigious transdisciplinary journal, she has published an article which I highly recommend. It's called Self-Defense is a Revolutionary Practice in Rojava, or How to Unmake the State. Okay, without further ado, I will pass the floor to Dr. Bayer, who will speak for about 15 minutes, followed by Professor Graeber, who will speak about... How many minutes?
Time? Whatever everybody else is doing.
20 minutes or so. and then we will turn the microphone to Dr. Üstündağ from Istanbul. For as long as she likes, and we will leave plenty of time, depending on how and what Nazan would like to say, for questions and answers, which will also be recorded. Okay, Daria?
Thank you, Aycha. I would like to thank you, Aycha.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yes.
So the podcast.
First, I would like to thank Aycha and her center for organizing today's talk. In my talk, I will give a historical overview first, and then I will try to establish that what is happening in Turkey against academics for peace is not a state of exception, but manifests the Turkish state's usual reflexes and its usual way of dealing with challenges against its official ideological stance, which is to suppress them rather than negotiate with or accommodate them. More importantly, its legal system is designed to make sure such contradicting views and opinions would be suppressed and punished. In the second part of my talk, I will briefly provide information about the possible legal consequences the Academics for Peace might face in Turkey on account of the petition they signed. However, I will try to be as brief as possible to leave some time and ground to further questions and discussions. Academic freedom has always been very problematic in Turkey, and many academics were prosecuted for defending ideas that contradict the official state ideology. For instance, Dr. İsmail Beşikçi, who is a sociologist who had worked for a state university, ended up spending most of his life in prison for saying that there are Kurds in Turkey and they are different from Turkish people and they speak the Kurdish language, which is different from Turkish. Actually, he's not the only one. Many other academics have lost their position and been in prison for many years after challenging the official state ideology and stance on Kurdish issue, like Fikret Başkaya, Haluk Gerger, and many others. Thus, what's happening today is not an exception or unprecedented. If we look at the recent history of Turkey, we can see many examples of these types of incidents where academics have been punished or lost their position due to their views or political opinions. The state desire to control academics in the country resulted in their being targeted because they didn't accept being an ideologically loyal servant of the state. Therefore, after the university reform in 1933 and following the military takeovers in 1960 and 1980, many academics were targeted by the military and civil regimes in Turkey for being a Kurdist or communist or contradicting state official view. However, the most extensive targeting of academics occurred during the 1980 military takeover, when the military regime gave extensive authority to soldiers to dismiss people working for state institutions whenever they thought it's necessary. As a result, many leftist university academics, as well as other civil servants, were dismissed from their position and they lost their civic rights, such as right to stand in an election or to vote. Those academics and other state servants who lost their position are known as Bindirtizikilikler. This name was given them after the article of the relevant law, which caused them to lose their position. And their rights could only be resulted, actually, until the 1990s. Actually, the academics, the incidents which most resemble what the peaceful academics are facing today was Aydınlar Dilekçesi, the intellectuals petition affair, which was signed initially by approximately 1,300 intellectuals. The signatories mostly included academics, but not only. Among them, there were writers, actors, journalists, etc. Some of the names, maybe you might know them, Aziz Nesin, Uğur Mumcu, Halit Çelenk, Erdal Öz. In May 1984, they submitted a petition to Turkish National Assembly and to the President's office, relying on their constitutional right to submit petition to Parliament. The petition title, Observations and Demands Regarding the Democratic System in Turkey, generally, in the petition, they generally criticized the human rights situation in the country following the military takeover in 12 September 1980, and were asking for the practice of torture to be stopped, amnesty for political prisoners, and all human rights and freedoms to be restored. And they also asked capital punishment to be lifted. The petition was banned on the same day, and the 5 days later, the martial court began criminal investigations against the signatories after the president and the leader of military takeover, Kenan Evren, referred to these intellectuals as traitors, Vatanay. Although the number of signatories was 2,000, the public prosecutor only brought criminal actions against some of them. Only 59 people were charged with violation of law number 2,969. Which banned people to make propaganda causing political conflicts or criticizing the leaders of the military regime or their action while they're in their office. The trial lasted for 2 years, and these intellectuals were finally acquitted by the martial court in Ankara in February 1986. Today, almost 1,300 distinguished academics in Turkey are facing the same threat in Turkey for signing a petition where they criticize the state for the heavy-handed, disproportionate response against the trenches and barricades put up by youth organization of the PKK. They have said that they don't want to be part of the crimes committed by the state, and called upon state authorities to comply with international human rights standards. They have also called upon the state to return to peace table with the PKK. However, the state response to this statement was rather harsh, and many academics were arrested and some of them already lost their jobs, while others were targeted by ultra-nationalist gangs and people. President Erdogan has referred to these academics as ignorant, dark, traitors, and rubble, and added, "You will pay for it. You will be punished." A mafia leader who openly supports the AKP government said, quote, they will take a bath in these academics' blood. End of quote. Following President Erdogan's statement, the public prosecutors have begun criminal proceedings, and the university authorities and the higher education authority, YÖK, have begun disciplinary actions against these academics. Now I would like to a little bit talk about the great threats these people, academics, are facing in Turkey, and answer the question of what might happen to these Turkish academics. There might be two types of investigations against these people. The first is criminal investigation. Also, they might face disciplinary investigation. So far, some of these academics have already been charged, and their statements were taken by the provincial public prosecutors in some cities. And so far, they are being charged under two articles of the Penal Code and one article of the anti-terror law. Actually, many of you must be very familiar with these articles, since they are constantly being used to criminalize those who challenge the official state ideology on Kurdish issue, minority issue, or Armenian issue. Moreover, the Turkish judicial system has been criticized for their use by the International Human Rights Organization in freedom of expression cases. The first article they might be charged with is Article 216 of the Turkish Penal Code, which penalizes actions for publicly inciting a segment of the people to hatred and animosity against another segment. It imposes 1 to 3 years imprisonment. Many of you will remember that this article was used against two academics, Professor Baskın Orhan and Professor İbrahim Kaboğlu, for their so-called minority rights and cultural rights report, which is known as Azınlık Raporu, in which they described the Kurdish ethnic group as a minority. Even though the report was prepared for the state's Human Rights Advisory Committee, as an advisory opinion, these academics were tried and punished, and their punishment approved by the appeal court, which criticized and criminalized them for stating that there exists in Turkey minorities other than non-Muslim minorities. That is the Kurds. It is only after increasing international pressure that the appeal court re-examined their case and acquitted them. The second charge they might face is Article 301 of the Penal Code, which penalizes insulting the Turkish nation or state authorities. It anticipates 6 to 2 years imprisonment. This is also a quite famous article. Armenian journalist Hrant Dink was tried and sentenced under this article just before his assassination to death by an ultra-nationalist. The Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk was also tried under this article for his remark that, quote, 30,000 Kurds and 1 million Armenians were killed and no one has the courage to talk about them. Actually, this article will not applied against this academic straightforward. The reason is that initiating an investigation under this article depends on the Ministry of Justice permission. Yeah, it means that unless government gives permission, the public prosecutors, they cannot bring any criminal action against the academics under this article. But so far, what we know, some of our colleagues, they were already their statements were taken by the public prosecutors. and the charge, one of the charges was this one. The third charge the academics are accused of is terrorism propaganda under the anti-terror law, Article 7, paragraph 2. According to this article, if somebody propagandized to legitimize a terrorist organization's methods or praise or encourage their methods, they can be sentenced for 1 to 5 years imprisonment. If such an act is committed through the media, then sentence has to be increased by half. If this crime is committed at a university and its premises, the sentence has to be doubled.
Oh my God. Here we are.
We are deeply, seriously in trouble, actually. During the KJK trials, there was a very big mass trials against Kurdish opposition in Turkey. It started in 2009, and thousands of people they were arrested. The number was 6,000, something like that. And then most of these trials they are still going on actually. And one of the people, one of the person who was arrested as a result of this investigation is Professor Büşra Erstanlı, who was charged under this article and accused of making propaganda for a terrorist organization because she gave lectures at the pro-Kurdish political party, it's closed down now actually, BDP's, Politics Academies, about autonomy and self-governance. In conjunction with this, she was also accused of being a member of an armed terror organization and taking part in illegal assembly. Actually, in the same case, another very famous writer, also he was indicted, and Dragut Sarakolu. Another threat to academics, as I stated earlier, is disciplinary investigations which might be carried out by the university authorities wherever they work. And as a result of these disciplinary actions, they might lose actually their position. I also want to, actually Ayça mentioned about them. There are many academics from all over the world who signed the initial petition, and actually some of them, they only work in Turkey, but they are citizens of other countries. Their situation is particularly interesting and fragile because they might be, as a result of this petition, they might be forced to leave the country. Deported from Turkey, and they may not go back to Turkey, maybe ever. Another worrying thing is that for those, especially Turkish citizens, academic, and who signed the petition, is that during the trial, the judge might ban the academics to travel outside of the country, which means whoever works abroad, Ayça and I, if we go to Turkey, if there's a ban, we may not leave the country, it means we might lose our job, or our life might be destroyed because of this. Anyway, returning to my initial point regarding the Turkish legal system thoroughness in criminalizing dissenting views and dissenting dissidents in Turkey, from time to time, we still witness serious lawlessness too. I will briefly talk about these curfews going on in Turkey. According to Turkish law, curfews can be applied only under a state of emergency or under martial law. Otherwise, in normal times, in peace times, there is no legal basis for curfews. However, although there is currently no declared state of emergency in Turkey, many cities and towns are suffering as a result of illegal curfews, and the state security forces disproportionate and careless use of force. The government states that the legal basis of the curfews in Kurdish cities is Article 11, Paragraph C of Provincial Administration Law. However, an examination of this law, this article shows that it cannot be used as a legal basis for curfews, since there is no mention of curfew anywhere in Sweden. According to Human Rights Foundation's report last week, during less than 5 months of curfew, 189 civilians have died. 39 of these people are children, 29 of them women, 27 of them over 60 years old. These figures indicate seriousness of the situation in the areas under curfew in Turkey. I also, very, if I have time, briefly talk about the general, like what happened, why the actually peace talks ended, and what's going on. I just want to like give a little bit political analysis, although I'm not a political analyst, but maybe this is my view. I think what's happening on the ground is that especially the PKK's leftist, pro-diversity, modernist, secular worldview, with an emphasis on gender equality, is ideologically in conflict with AKP's vision, which is framed by Sunni Islam, and it is with its politics composed of mixed Islam, Islamist conservatism, Turkish nationalism, and neoliberalism. The AKP's ideological claim of Islamic Brotherhood demands the Kurds loyal to the Turkish state through an uniform Islamic identity. This clearly distinguishes the AKP from the Kurdish political opposition, which mostly mobilized around the PKK and HDP, but mostly, not solely, but mostly, with their ethnic, secular, diversity-conscious agenda. Therefore, at least in the areas where the Kurds compose the majority, the two camps clearly rival each other. Further, the AKP's Turkish nationalist orientation entails intolerance towards any ideas of cultural and territorial autonomy for the Kurds. This is not only brings the AKP closer to the Kemalist political establishment, but also widens the rivalry between two camps. This rivalry reached a critical point when the leader of AKP, Recep Tayyip's dream to have an absolute authority over the state and country by a regime change from the parliamentary regime to presidential regime. However, this dream resisted and seriously disturbed by the HDP's successful election campaign in June 2015, when AKP lost the majority of the seats in the parliament. Further, the recent escalation of the violence and termination of the peace process by the Turkish state cannot be also understood without looking at the developments in Syria, YPG ruled Rojava, which is an organization they're known with their ideological proximity to PKK. Turkey seems so determined that they don't want to see another autonomous Kurdish setup in the region, especially under influence of PKK. Obviously, such setup would also pose a threat to Turkey's Sunni alliance with Qatar and Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, which is under serious allegations for supporting radical Islamic movements. In brief, it seems at the moment the AKP and HDP's irreversible ideological rivalry weakens any possibility to make peace with the Kurds and the PKK in Turkey. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Daria. Thank you, Dr. Bayer. Our second speaker is Professor David Graeber from the Department of Anthropology at London School of Economics.
Hi. First of all, apologize. I feel a little embarrassed being up here talking on subjects I'm not actually an expert in, the sense that I don't speak any of the languages. I'm not an academic authority on the region in any sense, so I should prepare you with that. I've actually been brought into the politics of the region for mainly as an activist and not as an academic. I was in Rojava in Syrian Kurdistan about a little over a year ago. More recently, I was in the southeast of North Kurdistan during the election campaign, doing essentially the HDP is bringing in people to election watching. So I was in Sirte and number of towns actually in Diyarbakir. It wasn't in Tizra. But you know, essentially I know bits and pieces. But I think on the other hand, I am in the position to say a lot of things at a university and not earn potential 4 years in jail, which I don't think anyone else in this panel is. So I guess I will say those things, which then should be said, which is in fact praising the methodology of someone who described as a terrorist group. So let me do that. It's really important to bear in mind what's actually happening, because there is an enormous blackout in the international press about what is starting to look increasingly like a civil war. I mean, you would think that a large-scale civil war inside a NATO country would be news, but in fact, you know, there's, you know, search the newspaper for updated stories on what's happening, and you see almost nothing. It's especially extraordinary because it's a part of the world where there's enormous imperial intervention going on. Other things happening in that region are daily news. So, you know, we read about what's happening in Iraq and Syria, we read about it all the time. And part of the reason, I suspect, is because there is such a incredible disproportion in terms of who has access to international media and who doesn't. The fact that the PKK has been put on the terror list and so by the US, in Europe, and so forth, basically means that nobody associated with it can make press statements. Or, you know, they can't send a delegation out to explain their side of the story. Meanwhile, the Turkish government, Erdogan's party, has been, you know, buying up PR firms, hiring, you know, former head of the CIA, I believe, and now directly working for the AKP and, you know, gaining access and trying to figure out basically how to spin a story so that people who just recently had been internationally hailed as the democratic heroes who defeated Daesh and Kobani can somehow be repainted as terrorists, despite the fact that they never actually do anything that remotely resembles a terrorist act. This is, you know, a challenge, but, you know, if you've got enough billions that you're willing to throw into it and enough important people, then, you know, it can be done. Or at the very least, you can stop people from talking about inconvenient facts at all, which is largely what's been going on. And it shows the degree to which, you know, I think that we need to understand what's happening to Turkish academics. You know, first they moved for the, after the journalists. It was a huge arrest, the terrorization, political suppression of journalists, also lawyers. Basically, any sort of independent voice has been systematically intimidated and terrorized. That's the only word for it, using the excuse of supporting terrorism. Terrorism which does not in fact take place because the groups labeled terrorism do not in fact make attacks on specifically on civilians. In fact, you know, they've renounced almost all forms of action which could be considered terrorism by standard international law. The only definition by which they're terrorists at this point is that any informal organization which conducts military operations, you know, could be said to be a terrorist if it's done for political reasons. But, you know, by that definition, George Washington was a terrorist. I think that what's happening, I was in a number of places, Diyarbakir a few months ago, and the situation, I think, it was clear what was going to happen, but nobody knew how the government was going to react. Essentially, after the first election, Erdogan said, no, basically I'm not going to accept the results of this election. He had his whole plan to create a presidential system where he would be sort of like the new Putin, of Turkey, an effective elected autocrat. He just built it was a 1,000-room palace, and exactly old is that. So essentially, they use the excuse of reigniting war with PKK as a pretext for creating a situation where people would vote for the ruling party simply out of insecurity to make it all end, to be able to use terror tactics against the civilian population in areas likely to vote for the HDP, which use various military means to suppress the vote, basically do everything they can to bring the vote down to the point where you'd get a majority in parliament and could wreak his will. It was effective. And people were anticipating losses. They weren't anticipating losses that they got. But it's very important to bear in mind that everyone was talking about, you know, at what point are we going to go for autonomy? And this is what triggered what's happening now. Because there's an extraordinarily centralized, you know, political system in the Turkish Republic, so that essentially you can win 85-90% of the vote in local elections, and often the HDP did, and basically still have no control over local policy whatsoever. You know, you still can't control like the bus routes. You can't. And in fact, it would regularly happen that when they elected a left-wing government, the first thing that would happen would be, you know, the districts that voted for them, suddenly they would stop collecting the garbage. Basic social services would be withdrawn. There was also a complete lack of rule of law in these regions, and the other reason people were talking about autonomy all the time was that people were constantly being arrested and held without charges, often for years. They didn't even have to have the pretext of making up charges. I mean, we met several people who'd been elected politicians one day, they were taken away, or put in prison, never told why. About 5 years later, they said, okay, you can go. So the situation was almost complete lawlessness and repression. And in that context, there was a move by youth groups. Now, this is not actually the PKK. You know, the PKK formerly are a guerrilla group who've largely withdrawn their forces from Turkey itself, but there are some that are still operating there. They're mostly now in northern Iraq. When they tried to, essentially they tried to initiate, well, what many call the Zapatista strategy. They were very much interested in the example in Chiapas of the Zapatistas, who had a basically 10-day insurrection against the Mexican state, and they said, okay, let's negotiate for autonomy. And they kind of knew that the Mexican government was negotiating in bad faith, but it provided a window by which they could create directly democratic institutions in the bottom up on the ground. And the PKK essentially decided that would be the strategy to pursue. They very much pushed for peace talks, they withdrew their major forces, and they tried to create what they call democratic confederalism in territories where they had mass popular support. Now that system is remarkably progressive, essentially a system of direct democracy. And it's an attempt among a lot of distantly inspired by sometime anarchist thinker Maurice Bookchin, but it's a very particular version of that which has been developed very much through internal political process dialogue in the region. And what it essentially consists of is a sort of nested series of assemblies. Every local district of a city, say, will have, say, 100 houses who group together have an assembly. They will choose delegates, not representatives, because they can only do what they're told to do by the local group, to larger groups, and these confederate on different levels. So it's a system of classical direct democracy. These directly democratic organizations also have, for example, there's working groups, so every assembly will have education, health, security, various other things. There's an extremely strong emphasis on gender balance. And any actual position of authority has to have two co-chairs, one male and one female. In the actual assemblies, there has to be at least 40% women present for there to be a caucus. And each group, and this is true both of the working groups and the assemblies, is balanced by an all-women's group, which has veto power over any decision they make, which they might adversely affect women, which could be potentially any decision. So what people told us when we were there was that since the government essentially provides no services to people in regions where there's strong HDP support, these groups, these youth groups, which are, you know, not directly, you know, part of the BKK, but they work with it, are essentially running their own bottom-up government. For example, health service. People won't even take their pregnant women to the hospital because infant mortality rate for children in the Kurdish parts of Turkey is like 5 times, I can't remember the exact numbers, but way higher than it is in the rest of the country. There's all these sort of almost calculated subtle forms of genocide going on. So they would provide health services, they would provide transportation services, cars. So essentially this shadow directly democratic governmental system, which is based on radical democracy and equal rights for women, was being created on the ground already. The question was at what point it would kind of come out and try to establish autonomy. After the elections and after people realized that a lot of the people who had voted HDP just to keep the AKP out of power had sort of abandoned them, the people kind of thought, okay, we're on our own, we're just going to have to do this ourselves. And it's at this point that people started creating trenches, setting up barricades, essentially as symbolic declarations of autonomy. And what people thought at the time was that the government would make a show of force and then negotiate. That Erdogan had essentially said, all right, I'm going to like start a war so as to get myself in office. And once I've got the majority, well, the smart thing to do would be say, okay, I'm a great peacemaker. And, you know, go out, talk, you know, let's get Erdogan and talk to him again, so forth and so on. It seemed like the politically astute thing to do, especially with the international situation being what it was, and he was getting a lot of trouble for, you know, fairly open support of Nusra, which is of course Al Qaeda, and at least passive support for Daesh. A lot of people were noticing this, so it would have been smart to, and that's what people assumed was were going to happen. People were rather surprised that the reaction has been almost exactly the opposite, almost total declaration of war. There's at least 52 24-hour curfews have been imposed on different municipalities in southeast Turkey. 24-hour curfew basically means you're causing people to starve, and you know, children sent to get bread have been shot in the streets, and use of armor and artillery, bombing of helicopters, jihadis from Gaza. I mean, if you're talking about state terrorism, you can't get any more blatant. I saw one picture of these Arabic-speaking bearded guys like writing "Be terrified" on the walls of cities where they're surrounding. So there has been a systematic use of state terror tactics against what is essentially a movement for democratic autonomy. I think one reason why it's impossible to get news stories about this is because there's really no way to spin this to make the Turkish state the good guys. I mean, you can't find any babies killed by the other side. You know, there's plenty of babies killed by the state forces. And for various reasons, owing to the geopolitical situation of Turkey, it does seem that the AKP government has so far managed to maneuver an okay from the world powers to do this. We saw the American vice president like just the other day going down there saying, oh yeah, PKK, they're outrageous terrorists, that's terrible. Which is basically saying, go ahead and kill lots of civilians. I mean, it's hard to read that in any other way. And this partly seems to have to do with everyone at least, you know, strongly hinting that he might actually go after Daesh in Syria, that the power of the refugees, so forth and so on. He's making for subtle game. And I can go on what's happened in Syria in comparison to that, but I guess this is not the place. What I think is very important about this, though, is that it does seem that there is also, there, since there is, seems to be an imperial go-ahead for this, one has to assume there is also something of a go-ahead for what's happening to Turkish intellectuals. Because, you know, I mean, Turkey is trying to fast-track to EU membership. You'd think that would not be the time to essentially criminalize the entire academic left, which is what they're, you know, in public, openly, in speech, of saying you're doing it. It's amazing chutzpah. Yet it seems to be happening, and I think this is one reason why it's really important that we break the silence that this has been greeted with. I mean, this is a real test case, I think, for not just for Turkey, but for the rest of the world, about what you can get away with and you consider a respectable actor in international terms.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you. What an important point, the last one. I hope people caught that. We are being a test case for what can happen to respectable actors, such as academics, in imperial affairs. So without further ado, we have Nazan on Skype. I will maximize you, Nazan. I'll try to maximize you. Are you ready? Can everybody hear Nazan?
Not yet, can you not speak?
Can you speak? Is it okay? Shall I turn it
off? What language was that?
No.
Can you hear her? Perfect, Nazan. The floor is yours.
All right. I hear my voice.
Oh, you need to turn off my voice, our voice.
All right, well.
Okay, just speak. We are listening.
So do you hear?
Yes.
All right. Thank you to Daria, Aicha, and David for having given the context. I was thinking that I would have to give you a lot of context, but now I don't need to. So I will directly go into our petition and just talk about academics for peace. How come that we wrote that petition? What is the context? What are we doing? What are we hoping to achieve? And then I will talk a little bit about Kurdistan's current situation. As I just mentioned, this is a very difficult time for me to even speak because we have 25 wounded people in Cizre in a basement stuck. Actually, they were 30 people 4 days ago, but five of them died because of blood loss, just a few hours ago, the Kurdish parliamentarians had announced that the ambulances will be able to pick them up, but then instead of ambulances, more special teams had arrived. This was a five-story building, and four stores were already destroyed, but now they have also destroyed the entrance, and we haven't heard anything from those 24 people, those who have survived the 4 days. We haven't heard anything from them for the last 5 hours. And three parliamentarians have just entered a hunger strike the internal affairs minister's building, but their phones have been disconnected. So we don't know much, and I am very, very tense, and I am really a little bit in panic, I must say, because we have friends there, and already a lot of our friends have died. So I have difficulty talking. Please excuse me beforehand if I don't make sense. Maybe I will be able to open up to ask me more questions. Academics for Peace was created in 2012. In 2012, I don't know how much you have followed events. Events happening in Turkey, especially in relation to the Kurdish issue before Kobani, because as far as I understand, Kobani has been a turning point in Europe, and after Kobani, more and more people became interested in the Kurdish issue. But in 2012 was a very important date in Kurdish liberation struggles. In 2012, Aicha and Derya have already mentioned, I think Derya did mention, I'm sorry if I mix up, Derya has mentioned that thousands of Kurdish politicians were arrested after 2009, and there were approximately 6,000 of them in Turkish prisons, and in 2012, they have entered a hunger strike. And for it lasted for more than 50 days. And their demands they demanded three things. One of them was their right to defend themselves in Kurdish, in their own native language. The second one was the lifting of Öcalan's, Kurdish Liberation Movement's leader, Öcalan's complete isolation in İmralı prison, because he wasn't allowed to see his lawyers or his family. And the third demand was the initiation of the peace process. So 250 of us have written and signed a petition announcing that we support their demands, and as long as their demands are not met, we are going to take every opportunity to talk about peace and the Kurdish issue, which means we are going to turn our classes into a platform for talking about peace and what and truth about the Kurdish issue. We are going to use conferences as opportunities for talking about the Kurdish issue, their demands, the liberation movement, and their demands for peace. So then we were 250 people, and this was a very successful petition in our opinion, because for the first time in Turkey, this was a petition saying that not only asking something from the government, but also saying what we will do to contribute to a peace process, what we will do to contribute to the liberation movement. But then, we were 250 people, and in 2013, January, the peace process really started. And the hunger strike ended before that, because Öcalan interfered, and he said that the prisoners should come out of the hunger strike, because their demands will be met. First, the demand to defend themselves in their native language was met, and in January, it was announced that the peace process will start. The peace process has started, but well, we don't call it usually the peace process, we call it the solution process. But it was similar to the peace processes in the world, at least as far as the first stage of peace processes go. And it lasted for a long time, until 2015. But after the events that Derya has... what did we do during this process as Academics for Peace? We have written a few other petitions. We have written reports. We have prepared... we have prepared certain edited volumes. We have written in newspapers on comparing the peace process in Turkey with other peace processes in the world. We have monitored this situation. We have made conferences on the peace process. And as much as could, we have actively supported the peace process and also demanded that the peace process follows some international, some universal standard. We all have as academics, of course, criticisms in regard to the international standards, but still we try to apply them to the Turkish-Kurdish case as well. And in 2015, with the events that Derya has cited, the peace process collapsed. But this was what happened in Turkey was not only the collapse of the peace process, but a lot of other developments occurred. Again, maybe you have followed them. There were three bombings, one in Suruç, one in Ahmet, and one in Ankara. And a lot of people, especially HDP, basis, people from HDP or people who demand peace led this leftists in Turkey, Kurdish and Turkish leftists were targeted by these events. And around 200 people died in those bombings in total. Afterwards, the first election happened. The president didn't like the first election, so we had the second elections. And during the first and the second elections, already the curfews have started. And the curfews, as they have started, is a response to the trenches that the youth have built. And maybe it should give also a little bit context on these trenches. As David has mentioned, these trenches are built by the youth of Kurdistan. And it's part of a self-defense movement. According to Öcalan, according to Kurdish Liberation Movement's ideology, any society needs to fulfill its need of nourishment, reproduction, and defense. And historically, Kurdish Liberation Movement's historical analysis is that patriarchy, nation state, and capitalism have stolen away the means of production, reproduction, and defense from people. From workers and from women. And what we need to do is build ways in which we can claim those means back. And the self-defense movement is part of that. Whenever there is something going on in Turkey, whenever there is the tension between Kurds and Turks, or the Turkish state and Kurds rise in Turkey, what the state does is mass arrests. Takes all the youth custody, arrests them, gives them long times of imprisonment. And this time, especially after the Kobani events, what the youth has decided is, okay, you know, they have all the means for violence, they have all the means for arrest. So what are we going to do? We are going to create our means of self-defense. We will not allow them to arrest us once again and to keep us in prisons for decades. So what they did is they built these trenches in their neighborhoods in order to keep the police away from doing house raids. This was the rationale of the trenches. But once the state declared curfews and the youth used these trenches to protect their neighborhoods, things came very quickly escalated. In the first curfews, the state couldn't enter the neighborhoods. So in the second round of curfews, now which have been lasting for more than 6 weeks, the state came with hundreds of special teams with all kinds of heavy guns, and they have started bombing these neighborhoods. And while they are entering the neighborhoods, they are destroying all the buildings. So basically, Cizre, Sur, these places are not enough there. This is not a normal curfew. This is destruction, complete destruction. So Cizre, Sur are no more. While these are happening, a lot of civilians are being killed. There are snipers on the top of buildings. So whenever something moves, they shoot them down. So children, a lot of children who are playing, who are, you know, trying to get out of the house, women who are cooking because they have to, or making bread because, you know, they can't go out, they can't buy anything, so they have to provide for their family. So they go in the garden to cook bread. So a lot of women and a lot of children have been killed by snipers. and bombs have fallen on in houses, and people were killed during sleeping or while they were doing their breakfast, they were doing making their breakfast. So okay, that's one part. Go back to the bombings, IS bombings. I talked about the IS bombings, the Islamic State bombings, and many people who have died, and elections. So while all these are happening, while all these were happening in Kurdistan, in Turkey there was an atmosphere of fear, a complete atmosphere of fear, because we were basically robbed from all our means of protest. When we go to a rally, to a meeting, well, we are bombed by the IS. Because the IS target the leftists and the government, we suspect, despite its intelligence, despite the information it gets, it allows IS to work. We can't go out again, we can't do a lot of things because there is the emergency law is applied, we are in custody, we are being arrested. The police became very harsh, using not only tear gas, but also bullets. So we were basically robbed from all our means of products. Besides maybe Twitter, but even in Twitter, when you tweet something against the prime minister or against the president, you are also taken into custody for having insulted the president. Now every day we have court cases on with the allegations of insulting the president. So this was the atmosphere, what was important, the question was, and debated in all the meetings we had, not only among academics, but also among women, among leftist circles, how can people from oppressing nation, a lot of the signatories are Turks, so we are part of an oppressing nation, we are the oppressors, and we benefit from the system, especially as academics, if not by anything, by the hierarchies of knowledge production. Mm-hmm. We are academics who go to Kurdistan, who write about Kurdistan, and who have careers built on talking about Kurdistan. So how can we, as academics of an oppressing nation, what kind of means do we have show that we don't want to be part of this colonizing system, because this is, we know we are part of a colonizing nation, but what is happening right now is a second colonization, is a second invasion. And so how can we say this time, when we have a chance, no to the second round of colonization, to the second round of invasion. We thought that, collecting signatures will be just a first. We had actually a lot of in our minds, but this step was enough. Not enough, but encountered with such fierce reaction. So I don't know how we are going to be able to take the second and the third step. What was amazing is in the best conditions, under best conditions, during these two times after Academics Forum was created, our softened petitions have already 250 signatures. And when we, however, put this petition in internet, over one night we had 400 signatures, and I remember calling one of the people who were collecting the signatures, like 3 hours after I had heard that we have already 400 signatures, and he said the signatures are now 800. And I said to myself, okay, now we are going somewhere. In a very, very short time, we had over 1,000 signatures, and we made a press conference, And after the press conference, I saw that one of the newspapers, which is aligned to Justice and Development Party, tweeted that we are betrayers of the nation. And I was very, very happy. I was so happy because I said to myself, yes, they have taken us seriously. The other tactic, maybe, which would be much more effective, would be completely ignoring us, pretending as if we don't exist. That would have been a very useful tactic for them, but no. They reacted. And this reaction made us very, very happy because it is without imagine how much we have robbed from means to protest. And I'm sure in Britain you can relate to us, because I think Europe is not exempt from that either. That left and resisting forces, opposing forces are robbed from their means to oppose. So we were robbed from our means to become visible as long as the government's newspapers had not taken us seriously as enemies, we would never have made the news. We would never have caught any attention. But luckily, they took us seriously. And in a very short time, we received support from all over Turkey. A lot of new groups developed, writers for peace, translators for peace, soccer fans for peace, musicians for peace, precaria workers for peace, unemployed peace. Of course, Women for Peace. We have now tens of groups who are supporting us. And what we are trying to do is have a large conference, large press statement, bringing all these people together. We cannot be on the streets. It is really, really difficult. Because when you think of protests, you think of streets. In Turkey, we cannot be on the streets anymore because we are scared of Islamic State bombing. We are scared of police forces. We are scared of special teams. And it's very difficult to bring people, especially the respectable ones, as David has said, the respectable academics, the respectable writers, etc., to the streets when the situation is so tense. But we can bring them together in different places. We can bring them together in press statements. We can bring them together in closed rooms, in meetings, and that's what we are trying to do. In a sense, you and I, and I think a lot of us share the same destiny. What kind of destiny? Well, the destiny of being bystanders to atrocities, to human rights violations, to crimes against humanity, and not finding any way of declaring to the world that we don't want to commit these crimes. We don't want our states, we don't want our institutions to take part in these crimes, which are committed in our name, in the name of security, in the name of peace, in the name of anti-terror. We have to find ways telling the world, you cannot, telling our states, telling our institutions, you cannot commit these crimes in our name. And that's what we are trying to do. I'm a column writer in a Turkish newspaper, and I was thinking of what I'm going to write today. And all that, I mean, it's we are going through as a world because of the civil wars and because of the because of how our countries are in işbirliğine ediyor.
Cooperation. Cooperation.
with those
cooperation.
Okay, cooperation, right. I mean, all our countries...
Collaboration.
Cooperation.
Collaboration.
Collaborate. Yes, collaborate. I mean, all our countries collaborate in these civil wars. So we are condemned, we are damned to live with a very, very poisonous knowledge. A very poisonous knowledge. And... how can we write as academics? How can we talk as academics? How can we cooperate as academics? How can we be in universities, do our work as academics who now have this poisonous knowledge? It's a very urgent question, I think, a very urgent global question. Yeah, that's all I can say for now, but to ask any more questions, I would very much appreciate that. It maybe help me to talk more about the issues that interest you, and just please pray or do whatever you believe, so that these 24 of our friends become rescued. And just one more thing before, I must also say that we do as, I'm also a member of Women for Peace, and these civil wars happening all over the world and Turkish war against Kurds, we don't only see as a war against Kurds, we also see it as a war against women. Because a lot of women have been killed during this war, and not in, I mean, for example, friends of us have been killed, but after they were dead, police officers have shot in their vagina. We had our three friends in Suruç, sorry, in Silopi. With whom I know them very well. We have we had fought together against violence against women. We have participated in many different women's conferences, and they were wounded. And when they were wounded, they called all of us. They wanted help, and PMs in Turkey, again, parliamentary, Kurdish parliamentarians have given their coordinates to the police so that they would stop shooting there and the ambulances could go there. And people have watched the ambulances go there, but the ambulances never came back. And one day later, all three of them were found in the morgue without their heads. So. This is the kind of war that's happening, and this is the kind of war that's happening in the Middle East, and not only in Turkey, and it's spreading everywhere. And I think it's very important for all academics to stop everything and ask ourselves what kind of work will we do with this very, very poisonous knowledge.
Yes, it's difficult to speak with that poisonous knowledge, yet we must break the silence, I think. Thank you, Nazan. I can barely speak, so I will turn it to the audience in case somebody is able to ask a question. to all of our panelists, please. Nazan, I have a question.
Can you hear me?
Sure. Yeah.
When did you become aware of what you call the poisonous knowledge that the great powers, or I don't know how you want to call them, and David also drew attention to this, that the academics in Turkey, as well as the attacks taking place in Cizre by the Turkish state forces, the current situation in Turkey has become a test case, David said. And you spoke of this poisonous knowledge that throughout the world, civil wars are taking place with the collaboration, that was the word we were looking for, of, I don't know what you would call them, but the old lexicon would call them great powers and not so great powers as well. So when did this all begin and how will it end? This is for Daria, David and Nazan especially.
Well, I would like to answer that. Is that okay?
So, yes, of course.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to go around all of us?
Okay. Okay. How did it start? I guess this is like Turkish state's it's more to do with like how they understand how to govern, it's part of their understanding of governance and what they've been trying to do throughout the modern Turkish history, at least, they were trying to unify people under two distinct identity. One is like Turkish ethnic identity, mm-hmm. and the second one is Islamic Hanafi Sunni version of characteristic. They were trying to bring people under these two umbrella. Although the Turkish leaders, they wanted to call themselves laik, secular, but they never been secular throughout the modern Turkish history. And they were very much actually attached to that Islamic Sunni identity. And everything started from that point. Like, there was a paradigm change from Ottoman Empire to modern Turkey, Turkish state. And in this paradigm change, what we see is that like, from a plural being and having a plural society, and then like phrasing that, they came to a conclusion that, okay, unifying in all sense, like ethnically, religiously, and ideologically, more importantly, ideologically, required these three things, were required if you wanted to be joined the national the nation. If you wanted to be a part of the Turkish nation, you would require these three things, actually. And this is so important. And the first one is like, okay, you have to speak Turkish, you have to be Turkish, and then the Sunni, Hanafi, Muslim, and also you needed to be Turkish nationalist. And what they were asking throughout the Turkish history to the people who were non-Turkish or non-Muslim, non-Sunni Muslims, were that, okay, you also, besides being Hanafi, Sunni, and Turkish, you have to be also Turkish nationalist. If you're not Turkish nationalist, if you're not close to that ideological stance, you were excluded. What's happening to academics today is actually as a result of this as well. Like most of these academics, they are looking at the world from a different ideological stance, and they are challenging the state from every aspect, and they don't have that kind of worldview. And I think this is the the cause of it. And in the today AKP government, actually at the beginning we thought maybe like they had in their discourse they were using these pluralities, and then they were praising the differences, and then they were saying they have a different idea, a different stance. But at the end, what we've seen, they get closer to Kemalists authoritarianism, and they are very much now defending the old establishment, and they are also Turkish nationalists, and they are, you know, trying to promote the Sunni Hanafi version of Islam in the country, and that's the reason we are having these problems there.
Thank you, Daria.
The anti-pluralism is
David, on the poisonous knowledge.
Well, I mean, obviously, I have no business, you know, talking about Turkish politics or rendering judgment on that. I guess I could talk a little bit about the international perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that if you're looking at it from the perspective of imperial intervention in the region, you know, it seems puzzling sometimes what's going on. During the siege of Kobani, it was almost bizarre. You know, you have two NATO powers, you know, one of whom is bombing one side of the conflict, the other of whom is supporting those same guys at the border, you know. And they're like operating completely at cross purposes. This is the weirdness of empire going on. And I thought at the time that, you know, if there's ever a sign of declining imperial power, you know, it's that, like, you know, what the British Empire ever put up with something like that, the Romans ever put up with something like that. But I mean, like, so you have to wonder why is this happening, or why is this being allowed to happen at the doorstep of Europe, right out in the open? It's an utter violation of the very principles on which, you know, the ideology of empires will uphold rights of things like women's rights, freedom of expression, all these things that are supposed to be Western values, have traditionally been used as an excuse for intervention in the region. It seems like it's going the opposite way. And I think that a figure like Erdogan, from the perspective of an American imperialist, for example, he was kind of their dream. Now, this is the guy they always wanted. He's like, you know, he's an Islamist, but he's not that Islamist, and he's a neoliberal, and he's like totally willing to play the game. And, you know, this is the guy they really wanted to replace Saddam with in Iraq, but they couldn't find him. This is the guy they really wanted to come out of the Arab Spring, they couldn't quite get that. You know, he's the perfect, you know, and I think to some degree, it's interesting to see how far you have to go to sort of lose the support of the imperial powers who claim to represent exactly the opposite of what he stands for. So it's very interesting in this case. I mean, the other very interesting thing in terms of imperial propaganda is the reaction to the Kurdish movement, which I think is just from complete confusion, I mean, into the propaganda machine that exists. This was most dramatic a couple of years ago in Sinjar, where the U.S. was going to intervene. We're setting the whole thing up. U.S. intervention was going to be based on saving the poor and besieged, you know, Yazidis who were surrounded by genocidal terrorists, which they were. You know. And they were going to use as a pretext to send U.S. special forces. And suddenly the newspaper story completely dropped, right? No, you know, everybody's like, what happened to those guys? You know, there's like one story I saw in the American news saying, they sent some rangers, they said they're out of danger, it's okay. I didn't say why. And it turns out, you know, PKK and FAJ, you know, sort of joined forces, and they were actually spearheaded by units made up all of women, you know, cut their way through Daesh lines and rescued them. So those guys are on the terror list. So, you know, how do you tell the story of, like, heroic feminist terrorists save babies from genocide, never mind, you know. They just, like, it just disappears. It's an untellable story. And there's a lot of untellable stories going on right now in that regard. Because they're quite a bit of a contradiction. They've been using the idea that people in the Middle East are, you know, they're these benighted primitives who don't understand democracy, they don't understand women's rights, we need to bomb them to liberate them from their own backwardness. And you know, all of a sudden you have these movements arising that actually believe in democracy and women's rights way more than any Western power does, and or take those principles way further. And, you know, rather than tell the story, and the obvious reactions are, whoa, that's going way too far, you know. Actually, we kind of like the supposedly moderate Islamist much better. But, you know, they can't actually say that. So, you know, it has caused the black on all discourse at all. So this is why actually what we're doing is so important. This is why an attack on academics, on journalists, on anybody who could actually talk about what's happening is actually an inherent part of the strategy. They can't do that without suppressing the information of what's happening. That's why what we're doing is so crucial, and why we should all go out and try to actually make people address the issue of what's happening. Because if you do know what's happening, the facts tend to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David. Nazan, the floor is yours again.
Well, I can only add that I don't see what's happening in Turkey apart from what's happening against migrants in all over Europe. I see it as separate from rising right in the US. I don't see it different from Israel's war against Palestine, nor America's war US war against Iraq, because they use the same strategies, same tactics, and it's always telling the majority that these are wars fought in your name, for you. You know, in Denmark, they have just had a law saying that any migrant, any refugee who arrives to Denmark and has more than 2,400 euros on him or her as jewelry or as cash, that money will be taken away from them to pay for their expenses. And that law is passed saying to the Danish people, you know, because all money we spent for refugees is spent out of your taxes. And Danish people give consent to this. The same occurred in the US. US invasion to Iraq, the same occurs in Israel. The same occurs in Turkey. The government tells Turkey, you know, we are doing this in your name to protect you from terrorism, in the name of peace. This is a worldwide strategy. This is the third world war.
Yes.
It's not led by great powers we can identify. It's networks and it's assemblages that come together under these truth regimes, which need to be destroyed, which need to be unmade, deconstituted. And I see, maybe because I am in the Middle East, but I feel like we are going to the Third World War. I feel like, and that's why it's not much poisonous, because it makes you aware of the fact that what's happening right now in the world is a life or death issue. It concerns everyone, every single one of us. It concerns every woman. It concerns every worker. It concerns every minority, every migrant. I think we have to unsettle these strategies, unmake these networks. True knowledge, true truth, true action, and we have to, you know, we cannot unmake this poisonous knowledge. We have to live with it. We have to live through it. That's all I can say.
Thank you very much, Nazan. I do have a response to it, but I see a question. I'll take three questions at once and give them. Yes, please, go ahead. Three at once, please.
Okay.
Would you mind kindly identifying yourself, where you come from, your name?
Okay. So my name is Yilmaz Ali. I'm a research scientist at Imperial College London. I have a question to David and to Nazan regarding the Kurds and the PYD positions. Can Nazan hear me, by the way?
Nazan, can you hear the question? Yes.
The Kurds initially in Syria have taken a position which was seemingly very marginal at the beginning from the outside, which was a position that was not supported by the Western allies. It was not supported by the Salafi movements like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And they were basically not on stage, but they especially with Rojava and then with Kobani, they went through an inflection point and made their case. And then they were on stage, and now they are very important. And a lot of paradigms have been collapsed that the Arab Spring movement would land in the hands of Salafi movements. Uh-huh. And so would the Kurds be able to do a smart move as they did in Syria? Do you think that a similar surprise might happen in Turkey, actually?
Okay, thank you very much. The second question, the gentleman in the back, would you mind identifying yourself?
It's not so much a question as a point about the international solidarity.
Sure.
It's been very useful to...
would you mind identifying yourself?
Yes, sorry, my name is Mike and I work in a university. I'm a member of the support staff there and a member of the Unison National Trade Union.
Thank you.
It's worth making the point that the tremendous efforts that the and the difficulties that the Academics for Peace movement has encountered has sent shockwaves through the world of academia, and many spontaneous petitions in solidarity and support have been organised. The most recent one I read of included 28 Nobel Prize winners on Monday declaring their solidarity with the Academics for Peace movement. And I've seen reports of thousands signing of academics across the world signing petitions, over 1,500 in Germany, rectors and leaders of universities in Germany, Austria, Sweden, and other countries, trade unions for education staff in Australia and New Zealand have also called for solidarity. This is absolutely excellent, and it's absolutely necessary in order to ensure that the Academics for Peace group are not isolated and picked off, but are seen as part of the global solidarity movement. So I think that is one message that people should go away from. This is not just a fight that is going on in Turkey, but it's a fight that's going on across the world. But David was quite right to raise the question, why is it that countries, particularly Western European countries, are so silent on the question? Of course, Turkish membership of NATO and its closeness to the European Union and the Western alliance is very, very important in that, particularly in terms of pressures that we may want to bring, particularly in this country. I, as a British citizen, want to bring pressure on my government that works allegedly in my name in order to ensure that Turkey is isolated and pressure is put on them. But the British government seems at the moment to be immune and refusing to condemn such gross violations of academic freedom. And part of it, of course, is that within our country, although academics in Britain notionally have freedom of speech as a result of legislation that passed nearly 30 years ago, the Counter-Terrorism and Security Act that was introduced last year brings a requirement upon educational institutions to, including universities, to monitor and report alleged movements towards terrorism. And of course that terrorism list that's maintained by the British Home Office includes the PKK and various associates. So these are all part of the campaign that's needed. There is a very active, I'll just finish, there is a very active solidarity movement active in London, particularly based around the London Borough of Haringey, which I used to live in. There is a demonstration being called for March the 6th to organise solidarity and put pressure upon the British government to condemn the latest acts by the Turkish government. There will be an organising meeting for that next week in the Kurdish centre in Haringey, if anyone is interested. And if anyone wants to find out more about that organisation, they can see me afterwards.
Thank you very much. That was an important statement for us to hear tonight, I think. And the third and last question in this round.
Hi, my name is Gülden. I am just an ordinary citizen.
Of which country?
From which country? I think my question is going to be probably to Nazan. This is maybe more than a question, only to you, maybe to all of us, because I am asking this question to myself. Since I have been witnessing this brutal state violence, let's say, you know, recent few months. But I could say that we used to have an excuse before when we used to say that we didn't know what was happening in Kurdistan. But now it's actually through the social media, we don't have that excuse at all. So my concern or my question is that, especially the western part of the country, although this silence is still going on, and the division between this in the society and the hatred against the Kurds, mm-hmm. even though what has been happening right in front of all our eyes, everybody's eyes, even not us, the whole world's eyes, and still this silence going on. And as a humanistic point of view, I find this unbearable, this silence. So. And this makes me really think that is this because we now don't have any excuse. So is this gonna make us to feel that this relationship between Kurds and Turks will be mendable?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the question I am asking myself and maybe to all of us.
Thank you very much, Gürtan. That's a very important question. Nazan, did you get the question? You heard it. Okay, our panelists, would you like to respond to any of the three?
Well, I can do the
three?
First one.
Yes, David.
Yeah. I mean, the simple question is it's not a difference of what they're doing, it's a difference in their situation. You're comparing the PYD in Syria and the PKK. It's not really that, like, you know, they were just hanging around in the background and they jumped on the world stage. In both cases, there's a consistent strategy, which is to abandon calls for a separate nation state, to instead go for a formula where you want autonomy within existing national borders, however, to combine the demand for autonomy with a plan to democratize the actual structure of the government, whether it was Syria in one case, in Turkey in the other. In the case of Syria, that's got to be pursued by trying to make alliances with other rebel groups because they won't work with the Assad government for obvious reasons. In Turkey, this means having to pursue a national electoral profile. Problem is, the attempt to when they were too successful at doing it through electoral means, the government just declared war. So I mean, that's basically what happened. The strategy is similar, it's just the situation is completely different.
Thank you, David. Daria?
Yeah, I just want to address Duncan's question. Is it mendable, the relationships between Kurds and Turks? For a long time, I mean, we all know that, the Kurdish, we know that there's a problem in Turkey and its name is Kurdish problem, Kurdish issue. But to be honest, what we had in Turkey until now, it was a Turkish problem. The problem of Turks, their difficulties to understand or accommodate the demands of these people or to deal with these people. Not only Turkish state itself, I think Turkish people also, they couldn't understand what's happening, and that's why they never show any empathy or they never show any, they try to understand or to react to this. But today, I think the problem is now becoming a Kurdish issue. I think Kurds are losing their faith in something good might happen, in near future. I think this is the problem now. And now we can talk about Kurdish problem from now on, in my view. Not, it wasn't a Kurdish problem in the past. But obviously the Turkish problem is still there. It was there before and, I think it's going to be there for a long time. But I think starting to have Kurdish problem, that's going to really cause a lot of problem from now on.
Thank you, Daria.
I'm not so, optimistic.
You're not optimistic?
No, I'm not really so optimistic. Obviously, I am so grateful seeing that, especially the people like Academics for Peace. But looking at many years ago, there is a lawyer, he's an MP now from JFF. He said, we are the last generation. You can make a peace with. Actually, the mm-hmm. the people around our age is the last people Turkish people and Turkish state can make peace with. I think from now on, like those who were born into the war and brought up in that kind of environment, and they are the one who is more radical, and they want something more than, I mean, in the past, like what we were talking about as a Kurdish demand, Kurdish language and this and that, now they want their autonomy, they want more, and what they want is like uncomparable to before, and they are more challenging now. I think from now on, we can talk about Kurdish issue, and I'm not so optimistic whether their, you know, voice might hurt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, Darian. Nazan?
Well, to the first question, I can say PKK always does rises. So, in Turkey, I don't know, but hold on just a second. It tried to do the same thing as in Rojava. It worked to some extent, it didn't work to some extent, the actors were different, the experiences were different, organization was different, although yes, the ideology was very, very similar or the same, and the results have been different. But I think if you look at the Kurdish liberation movement's history, it always comes up with new solutions. Because of its very organic character, I mean, Kurdish people, Kurdish liberation movement, the guerrilla, the civilians, the political actors, all act like an organism, like a monstrous organism. What kind of strategy will come out of that very monstrous organism is always right. That's what I said. I'm not hopeless in terms of the current situation in Turkey. Well, to the second one, I think this is a very powerful and useful, though rhetorical question. A lot of people are saying this. People who live in Cizre say this to people in Diyarbakir, to the people from Diyarbakir say it to people from Van. People in Kurdistan say it to people in Turkey. People left in Turkey say this to Islamists in Turkey. So this is a circulated question which puts everyone on stage. And therefore, I think it's a useful and powerful question, but the answer is much, much more complicated than conscience or humanity, I think. I also think even if the relations between Kurds and Turks, from Cizre and Diyarbakir, Diyarbakir and Van, but most important, of course, because more drastic and more pronounced, the relation between Kurds and Turks. If that becomes unmendable, I think this is not a bad thing. Because then the question of Kurdish-Turkish living together will not anymore be posed in affective terms, but in political terms. We are very, as a Turkish person, I am very sick of all discourses on brotherhood, on sisterhood, on familiarity, on having shared a history, having sharing this or that. This is a political question. You have to recognize the Kurdish political will. You have to recognize colonial history, and you have a political decision must be made on how to move forward. And I'm very happy that affective discourses are going bankrupt in this new situation. So that we can actually ask more political question as far as the Turkish population goes. The Turkish people have to answer these questions politically. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Thank you, Nazan. Perhaps one more round. Yes, one, two, three. So do you mind beginning here?
Yes, well, my name is Nena, and I come from Bulgaria. I'm a PhD student here in Dortmund. My question, or maybe like an observation around the topic of solidarity, and how do we articulate a position which somehow aligns itself with the struggle of both Kurdish people in Turkey, but also of other territories and so on. Is like my concern is how do we voice out this kind of solidarity so that it doesn't strengthen our position of, you know, this self, like coming back to ourselves as academics and as someone who is like just like speaking from a rather safe position in which it is easy to speak of solidarity towards academics and other people in the like position which is imagined as if it's identical or close to ourselves, but then not raising the question of maybe the radicality of the project which is being articulated in places like Rojava and so on. So if we were to talk about this, then we would also have to question a lot of the premises upon which we're standing, such as like the critique goes towards capitalism, neoliberalism, patriarchy, and all of this. And I think this is part of the answer to the question why it is not being, like why those stories are not being told, and why they're not being, because it's very uncomfortable to, like it would be too shattering for an image of the West as it normally imagines itself to start telling those stories.
Thank you very much for that question. Actually, this perspective is one reason, or the reason, why the word academic was in parentheses on the title of this panel. It's a very important question and a very difficult one, I think, to deal with. Thank you for that. You, and then the last question will be from the back. Would you mind identifying yourself, please?
Okay, sure. My name is Mehmet Kurt. I'm an academic, both based in Turkey and here. Holding a postdoc position at Bilgisayar University and also an assistant professor in Eastern Turkey, Bingöl University. So I'm not sure whether I have a question, but maybe a point. Derya mentioned about the signers, the signatures, and what they can be faced to, and like basically the criminal and disciplinary investigations are the two options, she said. But maybe in addition to that, what I have been observing, like an intense mobbing in, especially intense mobbing in small universities, and especially investigation, not about their political demands, but let's say attending or coming to school from 8 to 5 or this kind of like ridiculous reasons, has already started. And I think they are really well to kind of navigate through this. And at the same time, most of the signatures are from new universities, are coming from the assistant professors, and they work as kind of like based on 2-3 years agreements, renewed contract. And I think Turkish state doesn't forget what you signed. So basically, their academic future, I will say, is destroyed by the state. And another thing about the peace process, this is actually mostly about my, let's say, I'm the secretary of Human Rights Association in my city, Sanatkar Derneği, in Turkish. And basically, I believe that the peace process has never existed. I was the secretary of this organization, and still I am, during the most peaceful period, when there was a negotiation between the PKK and Turkish state. And I would say, relatively like calm city, the city of Bingöl, really unimportant, a small city in the north of Diyarbakır. But still, like we had to deal with the human rights violations through towards students, I don't know, governmental workers and other people every single day. And even I can say that actually the toleration that once guerrilla had because of the negotiation process didn't exist among civilian people in society. The level of violence in everyday violence was very intense. So I can say, like, I had a lot of students have faced all of this discrimination, and most of them actually are not happy with this, but some of them participated in guerrilla, lost their life, or just like quit school, and they are doing other things now. So when we talk about the peace process, yes, there was a so-called negotiation between the state and the PKK, but I don't think that in every level of society there has always been a kind of a discrimination about against Kurds and against their demands. So I don't really believe that there was a peace process, just once. Can I continue?
No, I'm sorry, I have to end this event, but thank you very much for your statement. As a matter of fact, we may have 1 minute each to respond, and the last question, yes.
No question.
Or statement, last statement. Why?
I was actually an amoeba, I did this and you put and I'm asking questions, so perhaps...
No, you can speak, whatever you have to say.
Well, I would love to speak, but I don't have any questions.
So make your statement, that's fine.
I was just going to ask if Nazan can say what's going on right now with the situation and how personally she's affected with that.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So 1 minute to Daria and David and 2 minutes to Nazan before we conclude the event. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Daria?
Thank you. Mr. Kurt is really, you know, very right. What was happening, it was my peace process anyway. State wanted, I don't know, they solved the issue with their own terms. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to hear the other side anyway. And that's the problem. That's why peace process came to end to an end, because they from the beginning they didn't want to hear the other side's demands anyway. And actually, one last point: what's happening in Turkey is just like in the terror law, it says if you defend the methods of a terrorist organization, mm-hmm. then you're a terrorist. Mm. Or you will be, you know, charged with that accusation. But what's happening in Turkey, if you defend, let's say, terrorist organization ideology, mm-hmm. or what they are, like, what they want, example, what PKK wants, if you defend that, even that, then you're a terrorist. That's the problem, I think, in Turkey. This is what's happening. You know, you cannot even defend their view by ideological means or like a peaceful mm-hmm. means. That's the problem we are facing in Turkey at the moment. I think we have to overcome that. Mm-hmm. Then we will start talking about any possible peace in Turkey.
We might as well shut up now.
We should. David.
Yeah, in addition, if you actually say that the PKK is not a terrorist organization,
exactly.
you can be prosecuted for supporting a terrorist organization.
You might be dead as well.
Yeah. Well, yes, yeah, she would be killed. And so forth. I was going to just say, I mean, two final notes. One is that you know, this looks like a civil war and an apocalyptic situation, but it's actually, the interesting thing is, we haven't talked about it, is PKK has actually been pulling its punches, because they have a very, very large and well-trained guerrilla force that could be going in there and actually starting a war. And if you count YPG, you know, there's like 30,000 very, very skillful troops who defeated Daesh repeatedly, who could just be in there fighting. And they are not doing that quite intentionally, because they still think that there is hope for a peaceful solution. And we're part of that strategy. That's why they're not doing that. So it's something important for us to bear in mind. Another thing I think is important to bear in mind is that March 6th, will be the national demo for the defense of Kurdistan. Is that how it's put? What's the official title of the demo?
Break the silence.
Break the silence, there we go.
It may change.
Currently entitled Break the Silence, assemble at 12 noon at the BBC building on March the 6th. Departing at 1 noon, marching to 1 p.m., marching to Trafalgar Square and the rally at 2. So I assume everyone will be there.
Thank you, David. And last but not least, Nazan, the concluding response, please.
Well, for the solidarity question, I always say the same thing. I'm going to say the same thing here as well. As I said before, this whole thing to be part of a larger third world war, and I believe that we are all actors in this. I believe all our, women, minorities, migrants, workers, leftists, everybody's, all principles and lives are at stake. And I see the Kurdish Liberation Movement and Turkish states attack and Kurdish states, Turkish states violations against the Kurdish movement as part of that. So I believe that we have to transform everything into a front and multiply the front. That's what I believe in. That's the best solidarity, I think. The other question, my own situation. Well, I'm already in the Dava açmak neydi Ayça ya?
Opening up a case, criminal case.
Suing.
No,
it's a civil case.
It's not
a
civil case, it's a criminal case, that's why.
Okay.
Bringing a criminal action against you.
You're suing who?
No.
You're already being charged.
You are the charge.
I am already charged for terrorism propaganda, for an article I have written in my newspaper column, and I have a huge file, so this is going to be added to that, besides that I get a lot of personal threats, but worse of all is that newspaper journalists like Orhan Miroğlu, like Yıldıray Oğur, one of them is an MP in Justice and Development Party, they regularly write about me and about a couple of other friends and blame us to be terrorists and terrorist propaganda makers and other kinds of things, which ends up each time in more and more life threats, in more and more threats by students and threats by government. But I am one of very, very lucky people because my university is a very relaxed university. They are not going to give in to government pressures to open up administrative investigations. But we will all be criminally charged. But as long as we collect, we stand together, as long as we stand as a collectivity, I think it will be useful that criminal charges are brought against us, because it will bring attention to the Kurdish case. It will also set an example, I think, for academics elsewhere. I'm not in a bad situation. Don't worry about me.
Okay, on that hopeful note, I think we can end the panel right here. Thank you very much to our speakers, and thank you very much to the audience for coming here this evening. now. Are you jump dancing?
Uh-huh.
Come on, cup of tea and coffee to learn.